today. What happens to the refugees and migrants who fail to make it to Europe and end up in Libya instead? And the world has been put on notice after a UN report shows 1 million species face extinction.
So August 26th last year, I was in North London, staying with friends actually, because I was just back on a short trip. And what I remember is that it was the afternoon, I was watching House of Cards.
In the afternoon?
Yeah, bit hungover. And I got this message on Facebook. Hi, Sister Sally, we need your help. We are under bad condition in Libya prison. Please, if you have time, I will tell you all the story about life in Libya prison.
Ever since that day, the journalist Sally Hayden has been sent hundreds of messages like this one.
Hello, hey, this is Major from Abu Salim Detention Center. We are in bad condition.
They're from refugees who are trying to reach Europe. Instead, they've been incarcerated in Libyan detention centers.
Please help us. Libya is not a good place. Libya is a war zone. We need to work it.
Since early 2017, the Libyan Coast Guard, with support from the European Union, has been intercepting boats carrying migrants. Many of those they capture are taken back to Libya and placed in indefinite detention.
So what they had told me was, a war has broken out around us. We're more than 400 refugees and we've been abandoned and we have no food or water. And they sent me photos showing people patrolling outside with anti-aircraft guns. So this all just seemed kind of crazy to me.
There are hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees in Libya, with around 6,000 thought to be trapped in squalid detention centres. And right now, they're caught up in fierce fighting in a country still in the throes of a civil war, which has recently been reignited with an assault on Tripoli. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, what happens to the asylum seekers being sent back to war-torn Libya with the help of the EU? Let me start by saying that in this episode, we talk about the treatment and abuse of asylum seekers in Libya. You may find some of the descriptions distressing.
I mean, I've reported a lot on migration, including in Sudan, where a lot of people go before they go to Libya.
Sally Hayden is a freelance journalist who has reported for The Guardian on migration, conflict and humanitarian crisis.
And so I knew of Libya as everyone describes it as a hell. I knew of it as somewhere that people go through a lot of suffering. But I didn't really know any of the specifics that I do now.
And what did you think when you saw that message?
I mean, I obviously didn't really take it very seriously.
Why know, obviously?
Because it just didn't seem that realistic that somebody who was in a detention centre or a prison thousands of miles away would have Facebook and be able to send a message, and particularly send a message to me, you know. But obviously, like, I messaged back just to find out more information.
Okay, I'm sending this message to the world to recognize that we are in suffer. We are sending this message straight from Tripoli, Absalom camp. We are 500 people.
What did you know about the individual who you were talking to? Can you give us any details about them?
He was in his late 20s and was from Eritrea and had gone to Sudan. And in Sudan, he said he was kidnapped, which is something that I haven't been able to verify, but I have heard similar reports from other people that Sudanese security kidnapped him, sold him to a militia, and that's how he ended up in Libya, that he was brought to Libya by a kind of smuggling gang and held for ransom, which is what happens to most refugees who end up in Libya. After they're held for ransom, a lot of them were allowed to try and cross the Mediterranean to reach Italy or Europe. He tried to do that. He was on a boat that was intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard and brought back to Libya and put in detention in Tripoli.
And how quickly did you write a story about him?
For the next 24 hours, I didn't publish anything. I just spent 24 hours just trying to verify in every way that I could. So I asked for a GPS location, I asked for selfies, I asked for photos of the detention centre, I asked for family contacts, so I even tried calling up their families. I was also contacting organisations on the ground, including the UN, and just telling them, you know, I don't know if this is real, but I've got a message saying 400 refugees have been abandoned without food or water, including women and children. And they're saying that they're in this exact area. I have a GPS location. And actually, some of them got back to me and said, yes, that seems to be true.
So did the UN do something?
Well, not for a while, because the war had just broken out. And strangely, conflict had broken out that very day.
The fighting, which started on Monday, has seen reports of heavy gunfire and shelling between two armed groups, one of which is loyal to Libya's UN-backed Government of National Accord.
So it was very unsafe for their staff to move around, and all the organisations that I contacted, and I got in touch with quite a few others, all said that we can't move to that area. That area is surrounded by fighting and it's not safe for our staff. So that was very, very strange and very hard to deal with, the fact that nobody could actually reach these people.
What happened to the camp?
Well, in that particular camp, it's called Ain Zara. It's in South Tripoli, and they had no food, no water, and were really desperate, didn't know what was going to happen. Eventually, Libyan authorities arrived with buses, and to them, you know, they don't know, because the big fear is that they'll be sold back to smugglers, and the smugglers will torture them again. And they're very suspicious that a lot of the Libyans are in league with the smugglers, which has proven to be true in some situations. And so they didn't know whether they should get on this bus. And they were all messaging me, should we get on the bus? I was trying to find out from the UN and other organisations, is this bus safe? And one UN organisation messaged me and said, you know, nothing's safe in Libya. We can't confirm for certain that this is okay, but we believe that the Libyan authorities are trying to do something. So eventually they got on the bus, and I ended up GPS tracking them across the city because they had no idea where they were going. And I just remember I literally sat there for about an hour just saying, you know, on your left, you should see Tripoli University. And they'd say, oh, we can't see Tripoli University. And eventually they arrived in another detention center called Abu Salim. And I contacted again, like I was quickly building up contacts, more contacts in Libya. And I said, is Abu Salim an official detention centre? Because they were saying they weren't sure if it was official. And my contact said yes. At the start, I thought that this was one situation. You know, it was one thing. And once I tried to get them help, that it was going to go away again, you know, that I'd move on to the next story.
But after Sally began writing stories about the refugees and their situation, and began to tweet the messages that she was receiving, word spread about her journalism, including within the detention centres. She began to receive voice memos via WhatsApp, one or two people asking for help.
Message to the world, as the world just watching us, what's happening in Libya. We're expecting to give us a rescue from this situation we are in.
Then more desperate to get their stories out.
In bad condition now. The war has come to us, please, all the organisation, please, we need help. We have kids, pregnant, six.
At first it was mainly men, and then women began to get in touch.
Hello, I am from Eritrea. I am the mother of twins. They are very in bad condition. The world shall make mercy for us. We need peace. We need freedom. We need to get out from the war. We need to get out of Libya.
I think now I'm probably, definitely over the last 8 months, I've been in touch with more than 100 people, and a lot of them speak on behalf of others because they might be sharing one phone between, you know, 20 people. The picture that I started getting through receiving WhatsApp messages was that there were like hundreds, I mean, eventually I realised there were thousands of people who are in detention centres who are just desperate to be heard, desperate for people to know what's happening to them. And there's a huge amount of abuse, a huge amount of people going without medical care. Like one group were left in a cell were in a hall without any tuberculosis medication and not allowed outside, didn't get any sunlight. And they just said tuberculosis was spreading through them. In October, one man set himself on fire and burnt himself to death in that detention centre.
What are these detention centres and who runs them? I mean, Libya is in the middle of a war. Is it the UN-backed government led by Fayez al-Sarraj?
So there's basically centres run by the Department for Combating Illegal Migration, which is associated with the GNA, Sarraj's government. And then there's unofficial centres which are run by smugglers. And the lines between those two aren't necessarily that clear. But yeah, in both there's a huge amount of abuse.
Most of the people Sally speaks to are refugees. Some are fleeing war in Somalia. Others are escaping indefinite military service in Eritrea.
In my life in Eritrea, I was serving the national service. I was suffering a lot in my country.
And many are from Darfur in Sudan, where they suffered human rights abuses. Some were put into detention as soon as they arrived in Libya. Others tried to cross the Mediterranean into Europe but were captured and brought back. Snatched videos show shocking scenes from within the camps. Hundreds of people packed into what look like cattle sheds, filthy, overcrowded, even bloodstained. Sally says it's wrong to think that it's just men being subjected to these conditions.
Like, I do think the media is kind of guilty for perpetuating this stereotype that it's all men, because a lot of the photos that are available are of just men. But, you know, I've been sent huge numbers of photos of children and women now, which they don't want me to publish because those women and the children as well are really, really vulnerable to retaliation and abuse. And the women, a lot of them say they've been raped, sometimes by Libyan guards or else before when they were being held by smugglers. And yes, some of them are pregnant either from rape by smugglers or just generally. And one of the women that I was in touch with, who was in Abu Salim detention centre, she gave birth last September. She was from Eritrea and her husband was from Eritrea. They met in Sudan and they had both escaped, and they went to Libya where they were held by smugglers and they were very badly tortured and they were moved between smugglers as well. Like, a lot of the time you'll pay ransom one place and then you get sold to the next place. And the husband managed to get his family to raise money, but they only had enough money for one ransom, and she was pregnant at this stage. So he paid her ransom and she went ahead and he stayed and was tortured again. And she tried to cross the sea. Her boat was intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard and she was brought back to a detention centre, and he managed to track her down once he escaped the smugglers and was reunited, and she was the one who gave birth during the conflict.
My God. And you mentioned that people were being forced into labour.
When there isn't kind of an active conflict, what I hear is that a lot of people are taken out to either build houses, work in construction, or sometimes do farming. And sometimes that'll just be in return for maybe some food or cigarettes. Like, they're generally not paid. And that might be by, you know, they're taken by relatives of the Libyan guards, or sometimes by the Libyan guards. And one man told me that's actually a really nice way to get some air, like, because he's normally locked inside without any fresh air. Like, a lot of it is obviously very sad, very depressing, but sometimes they'll send me quotes from Bob Marley songs saying, you know, every little thing is going to be all right. Or a lot of them like motivational speakers from America for some reason. There were various quotes that they were sending me about, you know, how you're going to get through things. I think because they're so desperate to feel like things are going to get better.
Ever since Colonel Gaddafi was ousted in 2011, Libya's been deeply unstable. I mean, when you first started speaking to the refugees last summer, there was fighting in the capital. And in recent weeks, tensions have really flared again.
This is a battle for territory, and land keeps on shifting almost every minute, certainly every hour.
General Haftar, who controls the south and east of Libya, advanced on Tripoli with his troops on April the 4th. And just this weekend, it was reported that 200 have been killed in the recent wave of fighting. How does all this violence affect the refugees that you're now in contact with?
It means that they're a lot more frightened. Like, they can hear bombs going off, they can hear weapons.
Are you waiting? Sally, do you hear that one?
They're worried that the centres are going to be overrun. In one case, a militia did come in and start shooting at detainees. And from the testimonies that I've received, detainees in at least five centres are being taken out and forced to assist militias by either moving weapons, loading weapons, cleaning military bases.
We unload all the weapons there. We unload many types of different weapons. For example, there were many green rocket refugee AK-47 bombs, even close bombs.
And certainly in a few cases, they've told me that they've been given guns and told to get involved in the fight.
I told them to return me back to the detention center, but they refused. They refused. And while I was complaining of going back to the detention center, one of the soldiers pointed a gun on my head.
One person that I'm in touch with said he had to wash military ambulances, and he was washing the blood of people who had been killed at the front lines, and, you know, was really upset by that.
I left my country, South Sudan, because of the war, but today it happened. I'm in war zone again.
It feels as if Libya's a long way away, but this is absolutely a story that has affected people in Europe. I mean, we all know about the migration crisis because we've watched it unfold. Men, women, children piling onto flimsy boats, trying to make the kind of perilous journeys across the Med.
Behind it, there is another orange dot, another boat arriving, and behind that, a third boat.
I mean, the image of Aylan Kurdi's lifeless body on a beach, and then a fierce debate within the EU about how to handle it. Angela Merkel had a backlash after she said Germany was going to open its doors. David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, under pressure perhaps from UKIP here in the UK, argued that rescuing migrants and bringing them to Europe could actually act as a pull factor.
We've already spent money erecting the border fence around the port at Calais. We're putting in place the border fence.
And turning them back instead, two countries like Libya could break the smugglers' business model. We don't hear much about European rescue boats at the moment. Why isn't that?
Well, essentially European policy has changed in the last few years. What they're trying to do is stop migration, as you said, because of political pressures.
And as I understand it, one of the ways they're doing this is that the EU has allocated millions of euros for migration-related projects in Libya, including 91 million for what they call integrated border management, which includes supporting the Libyan Coast Guard. What does that entail?
So giving them equipment, giving them training, what they say is includes human rights training, even though the Coast Guard has a long history of being very abusive towards the people that they intercept or rescue. And even how you phrase the work they're doing, like it's put forward as them doing life-saving rescues, but actually, in a lot of cases, they're intercepting the boats. So boats that try and leave Libya with a lot of people on them, they'll intercept them, bring them back and put them in detention centres. European leaders now speak a lot about how they've managed to stop migration to Europe, but they don't mention what's happening to the people who would have been trying to reach Europe and been trying to reach safety. What is happening to them is that they're being locked in detention centres and they're being trapped in this cycle of abuse. I've heard a lot, I've noticed it since I started reporting this story, that European leaders, when they speak about this, will speak about how they're preventing deaths in the Mediterranean, but there's no one seems to be tracking how many people are dying in the detention centres. And I even asked the EU spokesperson this. I was invited to Brussels to speak to people at the European Parliament last year, and I asked someone from the EU Commission And he said he doesn't know who's responsible for tracking that. He said maybe you should ask the UN.
It was very controversial at the time, but was it a reasonable argument to make that rescuing people on boats was encouraging them to embark on perilous journeys?
I think that if there was a legal pathway to reach safety, that all of the people that I'm in contact with, or almost all of them, would have tried to take a legal pathway. And I've noticed that people from West Africa, who I guess would be classed as economic migrants, a lot of them have opted to go home from Libya when they've been trapped in this cycle. But people who come from countries like Somalia or Eritrea or Darfur in Sudan, they say that they can't go home. And I think the fact that they've been in Libya for, you know, years at this stage in this terribly abusive system kind of shows that that's probably true. And they want legal pathways, but the problem is that there are too few resettlement places. So the UN is resettling people, but it's just happening very slowly. This year, they're going to move, I think, 2,500. But, you know, if there are 6,000 people in detention centres and then an unknown number of others with smugglers or trying to hide out on the streets, then that's really a very tiny amount.
And what about aid agencies?
Yeah, I've spoken to aid agencies. I mean, I think a lot of them are, the ones that are working on the ground, as I said, they're hesitant to speak out publicly about what's going on. But I think that some of them are trying very hard to kind of provide aid. But obviously, they're working in a very kind of ethically difficult environment, because if you keep providing, you know, say food or medication or anything to people who are in detention centres, does that mean that there's not going to be another solution for them, because it's kind of seen as something that will always be there?
So please, can you help for us, for all these people? So please, I say. I can't say more than this, because it's too much war and too much bad life.
The people you speak to, what's their ultimate hope, their dream? Is it a life in Europe? Is it safety?
For example, the mother who gave birth in the detention centre during conflict in September, she just told me her only hope is having a normal life. And I think that most of the people who I'm in touch with, they're not hoping for anything massive. You know, they're literally just hoping for someone that they can feel secure, and that they can try and do their best to, you know, either get an education or work or just be with their family.
Sally, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Sally Hayden. An EU spokesperson told us that engagement with the Libyan Coast Guard is because many lives are lost in Libyan territorial waters, where EU operations do not have access and where search and rescue operations can only be carried out by Libyan authorities. They said the training of the Libyan Coast Guard is only a fraction of our support, with most funding going to UN agencies and international NGOs, adding, there is no direct funding to the Libyan Coast Guard. They denounced the unacceptable violation of human rights and inhuman conditions of refugees and migrants, including in detention centres, and said they constantly push Libyan authorities to take measures to end these. We put the points raised in this podcast to the Libyan Government of National Accord. A spokesman responded and said the Libyan government takes any allegations of abuses, even isolated occurrences, extremely seriously. We are working with the international community to build capacity within relevant agencies and ensure that migrants are afforded the rights and dignities that all human beings deserve. He added, the scale of the challenges facing Libya is enormous, and the issue of large-scale migration is an international problem that cannot be left for any one country to solve on its own. Coming up, the transformative action required to stem a crisis in biodiversity. Now, the United Nations has put the world on notice as a major report on biodiversity reveals that 1 million species are at risk of extinction and human society is in jeopardy. Jonathan Watts is The Guardian's global environment editor.
This report is a health check on the planet. We're in a situation where we need some serious changes in our lives. We've known for a while, of course, that the natural world is in decline, but the pace of decline and the scale of decline and the fact that this is happening all over the world are really brought out in this report. We're told in it that the rate of extinction is tens to hundreds of times higher than anything seen over the last 10 million years. It shows that this is not just sad because they're beautiful species. It's worrying because we rely on these species for our life support systems. They're a staggering set of statistics. The one that was perhaps most striking was how our consumption of meat is impacting on the world. Grazing areas for cattle account now for about a quarter of the world's ice-free land and more than 18% of global greenhouse emissions. You can compare that to crop production, which uses 12% of land and creates under 7% of emissions. So you can see just how much of the world's resources are used up, particularly for the production of beef. So one of the messages of the authors is a change in diet. Okay, not everybody wants to become vegetarian, but to scale back the amount of meat, particularly beef, that you consume can make a difference. The message from this report is that tinkering around the edges is nowhere near enough. Very big transformations need to come, and that may well mean a really radical rewrite of what capitalism is, or something completely different. I think many people would say that capitalism is the problem, but the scientists and government officials who drafted this report were not willing to go that far. They called for new economic models. They called for a move away from being obsessed with GDP and being obsessed with material consumption. I think it's very sad. Well, no, it's more than sad. I think it's alarming that relatively few media made this a priority. It was on a few front pages, including The Guardian's. But for the most part in the UK, the headlines were all about the royal baby. It feels sometimes when you look at the British media in particular, but this is certainly true of other countries, that there are an awful lot of people in denial or burying their head in the sands or under the control of corporate interests that don't want change because it's their profits and their predominance that is threatened by change. The report says that it's not too late. If this is a health check, we are ill, but we are not terminally ill as a species and as a planet. The changes are possible. The time is possible. The technology is there. The finance is there. It's a case of mobilizing everything to this goal, making it a priority, making this an emergency, and really getting moving very quickly.
That was Jonathan Watts. My thanks to him and to Sally Hayden. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.